This workshop is titled Leaving a Legacy Instead of an Inheritance. And anyway, I was thinking about calling it Left Behind, and then but I was going to say the chilling story of what can happen to your children and your estate after your death. You know, as an attorney and working in the estate and probate area, I've seen some kind of unusual things. I've seen situations where after an estate is distributed, a son gets a divorce, and the ex-daughter-in-law winds up with the inheritance, or worse, her new husband gets it. Or your daughter runs into financial problems, and the inheritance is taken by creditors, thieves, or worse, the IRS, or worse, lawyers. You have a son who has a business, and it fails, and the inheritance goes to the bankruptcy trustee. Your son-in-law succumbs to a serious illness. With today's high cost of medical care, your daughter's inheritance is used to pay the expenses. Your son drops out of school or quits his job because the new inheritance is so great, and he lives off of the inheritance until it's gone, and then he has to start all over again. And there's no welcoming father to go back to, no fatted calf, no ring, no robe. And so it can be kind of a serious situation when we look at it. And what I like to tell people is that if you're in your estate plan, if you're looking at leaving to your children more than a year or 2 years' wages, then you're giving them a serious inheritance, and it could affect the way that they live their life or the way that they do their planning. And so in that situation, then it's helpful to take a few precautions. In the estate area, I can tell you that is that clear? Okay, good. In the I can tell you that let's go back up here. 50% of the children that receive an inheritance this year will spend it all in 6 months. 80% of the children that receive an inheritance this year will spend it all within 1 year. The average length of time before a major purchase when somebody receives an inheritance is 16 days. And one of the things that I think is most tragic is the divorce rates go up significantly following major inheritances. And you might say, well, we never had the money before. But these statistics would be very common to what you would expect to see with people who've won the lottery. And in essence, that's kind of what it is for a lot of kids. Because what happens with our estate is pretty interesting. Let's just take Tom and Mary Jones. These are an older couple that I've worked with. Tom's getting ready to retire. He was in the military. Now, they have a home, and it's pretty much paid for now. It's worth $325,000. They have a rental home in California where they were stationed. It's worth $200,000. Mary has a half an interest in a farm in Iowa. They have some investments that they put together, a retirement account, personal property, some life insurance. And you can see as you add these up, none of them are that outrageous in terms of large amounts, but the estate adds up to about $2 million. And what we begin to see, of course, is that we're worth a lot more dead than we are alive. And if our estate was to be liquefied and then passed on to a next generation, they would be receiving a lot more money than we ever had during our lifetime, or at least a lot more liquid assets than we ever had access to. And so as we start thinking through that process, it's sometimes helpful to think about how we want to pass those things on and what we want to put in place for our kids. I kind of work with the planning area in what I call the evangelism explosion method of estate planning. And that is, let's take a look. If you were to die tonight, do you know where your estate would go? And if we start from there, then we can move forward and do some of the other planning as we go. And so it's kind of important for us to take a look at just basic estate planning in the beginning and see where we would be at. As you think through your own personal estate, think of things like the cash assets that you have available, real estate, personal property, different investments, any business interests that you might have, retirement, and insurance. And so as you begin to get those things in your mind, you'll see that your estate can kind of add up a lot quicker than you think. And so it's important to kind of put categories in your mind of where things are so that you can properly plan for them. I have a little story that was in a newspaper. This is Donald gets a second chance. Boise, Idaho. Donald Roberts walked out from a wilderness area near Stanley on January 30th, months after he was given up for dead. He said that he hurt himself while hunting and decided to stay put in a rugged wilderness area. Roberts was missing for 85 days. Two different courts declared Roberts legally dead. A life insurance company was just about ready to pay off the mortgage on his home. A dispute had arisen between his business partners and his family over the estate's share of the company. His relatives were quarreling over his possessions. Mr. Roberts had the unique experience at a source familiar with the bickering that usually accompanies a probate case when there is no will. He's probably one of the few people in history who's had the opportunity to personally observe what happens to his property and debts, what happens among his remaining friends and relatives when he dies. I won't take a show of hands, but generally what the statistics tell us is that 70% of the people in this country will die without a will. And as I've reviewed things, 80% of the people who have a will usually have a will that's outdated or doesn't address their current situation. It was done maybe in the military or it was done a long time ago. And so that leaves a pretty small percentage of people who actually have a plan that will be followed at their death. But if you don't have a will, then the good news is, I guess the good news is, that the state has written one for you. And so you can kind of put your state in here if you want to. This is for Colorado. I, William Woe, of Colorado Springs, Colorado, being of sound mind, hereby do make and publish and declare this to be my last will and testament. I have complete confidence in the state in which I now reside and equal confidence in the courts. Therefore, should my wife and I both die and while my children are minors, the court can appoint a guardian to manage their affairs. A stranger would be acceptable, for I have no opinion as to who would best care for my children. Because of my confidence in the state, I authorize them to determine what property of mine my wife should get and what property my children should get. I understand and agree that it should be split, one half for my wife and one half for my children. As a safeguard of my estate, I require that my wife make an annual accounting of how and why she spent the money necessary for proper care of our children. When my children reach the age of 18, they can do whatever they please with their share of my estate, and my wife shall give a complete written account of everything she's done up to that point with that child's money. Because the government has need for money, which is greater than the needs of my wife and children, that may be true. I direct that no attempt be made to lower my estate or other taxes or probate expenses. And so if you haven't written a will for yourself, you do have a will that's been written for you by the state. But like any will, the will benefits the person who writes it. And so the state's will is really designed to benefit the state. I want to touch briefly on six areas of a comprehensive estate plan, and I wouldn't be a very good navigator if I didn't have a wheel illustration, and so I have a wheel illustration here to work with. You go through the first area, instructions and advisors. With your documents, very important to put down who would be the advisors to step in your place, how you'd want to see things handled. Where's your will? Where's your life insurance? Who handles employee benefits for you? Is there a safety deposit box? Where are their assets? You know, I've seen situations where people years later found life insurance policies that nobody knew existed. And life insurance is a situation where unless you make a claim, they don't have to make a payment. So that's a pretty critical thing. And also, when my parents died, we went in to move them out of their house. We're cleaning everything out. Two things happened. One is, we started to move this tool, this large metal cabinet, and it seemed really heavy considering it was empty. And then we saw that it had a false bottom in there, and there was about 20 pounds of silver stuck in the bottom of that. And you'll hear people from auctions tell you about what they found and where people put things. And just the same way as my parents also took some things and wrapped them up and put them in the freezer. Yeah, it's just ways that people use to hide things. Health care and incapacity, I'm going to cover those together. There's two forms that you need. One is a durable power of attorney, which allows someone else to make a financial decision for you in the event you can't make one for yourself. You're disabled. Usually that goes husbands to wives, wives to husbands, but it could be to parents or it could be to children if your children are old enough. The second thing is a durable power of attorney for health care. Now, this is an extremely important document, and there's actually two forms that go with that. The durable power of attorney for health care allows you to make a medical decision for another person or another person to make a medical decision for you if you're incapacitated. And so it allows your family to direct your medical care in the event you would become incapacitated. There's another form that goes with that called the living will, and that's probably becoming pretty high publicity now because of the Schiavo case in Florida, where they're talking about disconnecting the woman from the life support systems. If you can ever imagine a situation where you would want to be disconnected from life support systems, then you need to have a living will. And what I tell people is that's a document that you tell your family you have, and you keep it with your family documents so that if they ever need that to make that decision, they can produce that document and make that decision for you. Otherwise, you can see expenses rolling on, and you put doctors in a bad position of having to make that decision. That basically says if you're incapacitated, unable to, you're in a coma or unconscious, two doctors have declared you terminally ill or injured after a period of 7 days, then your family can produce this document and life support systems can be withdrawn. The durable power of attorney is the most important document because it will deal with 99.5% of the situations. The only decision that a durable power of attorney will not allow you to make is the withdrawal of life support systems. Yeah.
Durable power of attorney, can you have person A designated, and if they can't serve person B and C?
Absolutely.
Successors in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you can do too is you can have a situation where you could name two or three children on there too. So it could be an and/or situation, depending on what your personal. But yeah, almost always you would put a primary and then a secondary, or if you have, or more than one primary, perhaps. I'm going to cover charitable planning a little bit later. The will and the trust is kind of the central part of that estate plan. But these other things are important as well. When should you consider more than just a will? You've probably heard a lot of talk about living trusts these days. And living trusts are not just for the wealthy anymore. They're really valuable for a lot of reasons for a lot of people. I use a total estate value of more than $500,000. It really is up and down. Sometimes the estate could be less or more. That's not necessarily a guiding line. But if you have property in more than one state, you will probate that property in every state where you have it. And so even if you have a half an interest in a farm back in Iowa or your house and maybe a vacation property in Colorado, you're going to probate in those states unless you have a living trust. And so that right there is a good reason to have a living trust document. A living trust, very simply, is a trust that holds title to your property. You are the trustee of that trust, and so you deal with it the same way you would deal with your own property. But because it's held in trust, it doesn't die when you die or when your wife dies. And so it goes on to a successor trustee to be managed. In that way, it bypasses probate. And so it keeps your assets out of the probate estate. And if you've ever been involved with a probate, then you know when you file it at the courthouse, you've got to file your will so people have free access to your wishes. You also have to file an inventory of the estate. And so sometimes the privacy of a living trust can be worth it to you as well. If you have previous marriage or support obligations, a trust is a very important document because then you can preserve assets for your children from the other marriage. If you have a spouse or a child with a disability, you want that preserved in trust for them rather than giving outright, because if you direct an inheritance outright and a child or someone is on let's say Social Security disability or on Medicaid, you will disallow them from that coverage. And in a number of situations, really even depending on the value of your estate, some of the care that you can get under Medicaid and Social Security disability is very difficult to even pay for to get. And so it may be that you don't want to disqualify a child from getting those benefits, even if you have some assets that could provide for them for a while. And this kind of allows you to keep them, to keep those assets separate so that they can pay for things that what we call are supplemental. Things like dentist visits, getting your hair cut, visiting relatives, things that the government doesn't consider to be necessities, but we do consider to be the necessities of life. If you or your spouse are a non-U.S. citizen, then you've got some estate tax limitations, exemption limitations that are best addressed in a trust. If you have a closely held business, a lot of times this can keep your business from being sold to pay for debts. And then finally, if there's any potential conflict over assets, if you think that there might be any contest, any arguments over your estate that your kids might challenge or anybody might challenge, then the trust is a private document and allows you to keep those things separate. You know, a lot of people think, my kids, they're all Christians. Everything will be fine. But one of the things you realize if you've lost somebody close is that you're always going to be looking at that situation saying, I wish I could have talked to him one more time. I wish I could have said something. I wish I could have done something. There's always a lot of guilt that surrounds a death in some situations. And guilt is a bad environment to begin to make some of these decisions. And so what you find out is that people may not argue over the bank account initially, but they'll argue over the one wedding ring and the two daughters. The family album, the piano, that card, end table that has the teeth marks on it, things like that. And so it's just really a good idea, to the degree that you can do your planning now and you can put these things at rest, you're going to be helping your children in the long run in that process. There's an estate tax exemption now that is growing. It started a couple years ago at $675,000 per individual estate. That's now right at $1.5 million. And so what that means is if your estate is under $1.5 million when you die, you will pay no estate tax. And so that's a pretty good deal. That's going up progressively until 2010 when the estate tax is effectively repealed. And there is no estate tax. Well, that's what I was going to say. If you're thinking about dying between now and 2010, and you got an estate, I got this little device, cryogenics. Keep the old body alive and then bring it back and let it die in 2010.
Throw mama from the train.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I want to point out too is 2011, it flips back to $1 million exemption.
Die.
Small window of opportunity.
So you have a small window, a one-year opportunity.
In 2010, doesn't Congress have to vote on making the repeal permanent?
Well, sometime in that time period, yeah.
Then it goes back to work.
That's right. And so it may be repealed, it may not, it may be kept at one of these higher levels. We just don't know. But the way the law is now, it'll flip back to $1 million in 2011 per estate. Now, if you do your planning with a living trust, you can preserve both the husband's credit and the wife's credit, so you can actually have an estate that goes to $2 million without any estate taxes. And again, that you do that by putting a credit shelter trust inside of your living trust. credit shelter trust. And remember, you ought to know normally when you have a will, first person dies, I leave everything to my wife. I don't use my unified credit, so the full value of the estate goes into my wife's estate. And insurance is considered part of an estate if you own it personally. So when you think in terms of the total value, think about your employee benefits, your house, and your life insurance together. And all of a sudden you begin to think, my estate's not too bad. It's not money you can touch now, or that you get to use, but it's there growing in your estate. Especially if you consider that you're probably going to plan on dying at a later age than you are now. The cost of probate, I mentioned that before. Going through the probate process, in some states like California, it's a fixed percentage. 5% of the estate goes to pay those nice lawyers and judges and everybody else who handles the probate estate. So you can see that this begins to add up. And what I tell people a lot in my law practice is when you talk about doing a living trust is it's kind of like the auto mechanic and the oil filter. You know, you can pay me now or pay me later. And I know a lot of attorneys who have done a lot of wills and estate planning early in their career and basically retire on the estates that they're going to be dealing with. Now, in some of our states, some of the states, and I practiced for a while in Oklahoma and in Colorado, these numbers are probably a little bit high, but it just gives you some idea. Any money spent in this way is probably a mistake.
That's on assets.
What?
That's on assets, not net worth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember Tom and Mary, and we kind of went through with all their different assets. Their estate totaled up to about $2 million. Now, what do you think the taxes might be on that situation? Fairly straightforward. You'd probably look at it and say, well, I may not be quite as high in some of those areas, but that seems like a reasonable situation. Well, when we look at it with just simple wills, because the estate is collapsing into, you know, Tom's estate is collapsing into Mary's estate at death, and they have no probate avoidance situations, you're basically going to take that $2 million estate, pay probate and expenses at the first death, assuming the second death is after 2011, then you're going to have additional probate and expenses on the full value of the estate. You're going to have estate taxes due, because now we've collapsed that $2 million into one estate, of $345,000, and you're also going to have income taxes due. Why would you have income taxes due?
Retirement account.
Yeah. And so a lot of us are rolling forward with a pretty large income tax burden because of our retirement accounts. And so you see an estate shrinkage here of about 30% on what we would consider to be a normal estate. Or, you know, Tom and Mary might said, but I thought there was a $1 million estate tax exemption. And so each of us, you have our $1 million estate tax, wouldn't we be free of tax? Well, no. As you see, that's not the way it works out. And so that's kind of the process of getting, and I'm going to show you some things a little bit later on how we can deal with that income tax in the estate, even for smaller estates. You know, it would not be uncommon for most of us in the room when we hit retirement age to have a retirement account of $300,000 or $400,000. Well, if you're putting income tax on top, I mean, if income tax gets taxed on that when it goes to your heirs, then they're going to lose 30 to 40% of that money as it goes in because it's coming to them on top of their ordinary income. Now for the biblical part of our study. I want to take a look at how inheritance is viewed in the Bible now that we've kind of taken a basic run through the estate situation. If you look at Psalms 37:11 and 29, Matthew 5, what it seems to indicate is that character matters with respect to an inheritance. The meek and the righteous will inherit the land. And unlike presidential politics in the 90s, character does matter to God. Matthew 19:29, and everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. And so to God, Christian service matters. And the reason why I'm bringing some of these things up is that if these things are important to God when he thinks about leaving his inheritance, should we think about these things being important to us as we leave an inheritance for our children? Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as reward. And as we know, our work matters to God. What we do and how we do our work and our job. Matthew 25 and Luke 19, the parable of the talents and the parable of the minas, basically tell us that how we handle responsibility and stewardship matters to God. And so as you look and you see ahead, how you see your children handling responsibility and stewardship might be a good indication of how you structure the inheritance for them. Revelations 21:7. He who overcomes will inherit all this. And so a godly life matters. What can we do with our inheritance and our estate that will help influence our children to live a godly life. Proverbs 13:22. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. And so future generations matter in the inheritance process to God. And that's an interesting factor. And I've thought about this a lot. Why is it that the Bible would say a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children? Your grandchildren. And I think the reason is because during our lifetimes, it's our responsibility to make our children successful. And so we want to provide for them as best we can. A lot of times when we get into grandchildren, as they grow up, we don't have the opportunity and the input. And so we can structure some things in our estate that allow values to be perpetuated. Ecclesiastes 7:11, wisdom like an inheritance is a good thing. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter, but the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom perseveres for the life of the possessor. And so as we think through this process, I want you to think through what is it that is most important for you to pass on to your children. So many times in the estate planning area, what I see is people just don't give this any thought, and they say, well, I just want to divide my estate up and give it equally to my children. And a lot of times to me what that says is that I didn't get a chance maybe to spend the time that I wanted to or to direct my children in the way that I would have liked to have seen. And so I'm just going to give the estate outright so that everybody will think it will be fair and everybody will think I was a great guy when I died. But I think we have more responsibility than that. We need to consider, just like during your lifetimes as your kids are growing up, you treat them differently, but you treat them equally. That same thing might be true in our estate plan as we look at it. In other words, providing for them what is best. So as we come down to it, what do you owe your children? Well, I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from some famous people. Bill Gates says this, I won't leave a lot of money to my heirs because I don't think it would be good for them. When asked why he never chooses first class seats on his flights, he said, I don't want to get used to it. Warren Buffett says this, parents should leave children enough money so that they feel like they can do anything, but not so much that they can do nothing. T. Boone Pickens puts it this way, having one's work effort recognized by peers builds self-esteem. If you don't watch out, you can set up a situation where a child never has the pleasure of bringing home a paycheck. Gordon Moore of Intel, children ought to have a sense of accomplishment for what they have done, not for what you've given them. George Bush the Senior, together we can show that what really matters in the end is not possessions. And Linda and Richard Erie, who wrote the book Teaching Children Joy, a family should be an institution. A family should not be individuals grouped together for convenience where children live until they can be out on their own. And so when we think in terms of a family being an institution, what are the institutional values that we want to perpetuate? How is it that we want to be remembered? What is it that is our goal in terms of raising kids and passing things on? I'd like to maybe put forth this goal for you as just a place to start. Our overall goal for our sons and daughters is that they grow into mature, independent, godly adults who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, and who will face good and difficult situations with calmness and perseverance, who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents. And as you look at that, you think, where does money fit into that process? Well, it's not so much money as it is what we can do to provide influence. You know, so many of us, and our children will struggle with this too, they struggle with the myth of the American dream, that money really can and does guarantee success and happiness. If you don't believe that that's true for you, then why would you set up a situation where you're passing that value on to your children? Unfortunately, though, for many of us, and this is true too, George Bernard Shaw put it this way: I've been poor and I've been rich, and I like rich better. But 80, what the statistics will tell us is that 80% of the millionaires in this country right now are first generation. They made their own money. These are some success factors that people have listed as being successful. You don't have to take these down. These are just some of the things that, as successful people have been questioned over the years, these are the things that they said were most important to them in their success. Being honest, being well-disciplined, getting along with people, having a supportive spouse, working harder than most other people, loving your career or business, being well-organized, having an ability to sell your ideas or products. Again, these are all character issues that lead to success. And so I want to put forth a couple of different positions here as we think about success. And again, we think about passing on those family values. The first is helping to develop courage in our kids' lives. To think of successes rather than failures. You know, I spent the early part of my life working with troubled kids. And one of the things, and teaching in that arena, and one of the things I found was that kids who come from negative environments, where they are put down a lot and have low self-esteem, need to be rewarded or complimented 10 times more than a person who has a high self-esteem. And so, in that process, be lavish with your compliments and your praise for the right thing. Help people dwell on their successes rather than on their failures. Structure help your kids believe in themselves and in hard work. Nearly 40% of the people that were mentioned in this study said that religious values or their religious faith was one of the most important strengths, and that's just generally across the board. So I think that's an encouragement too. Select a vocation that you love. You know, a lot of times we have kids who are making decisions now in college for a vocation or a job because they think that that'll be the job that they can make the most money in. And what you wind up with is you wind up producing kids, or kids wind up coming about in areas and vocations that they don't like, and they wind up being dissatisfied, which causes them, it's just a trickle-down effect through their whole lives. If you find something that you're good at and that you really enjoy, then you'll put your heart in it and you'll be successful in it. And you'll have a much happier life. And so encouraging our kids to find those things that they're good at and that they enjoy doing and to follow through on those dreams, even if that might be a psychology major in college. Find a good mate. You know, I heard someone tell me a while back that they'd been praying for their children's spouses ever since the kids were born. And so we kind of adopted that policy. But we have three children now that are all married and happily married and found good spouses in that process. But as you can relate, a spouse is a very important key to success in life. And so situations where you can get to know that spouse, or you can get them involved in your family to see where they're involved, or the future spouse, very important. Good advisors and mentors. Of course, we believe in that in the Navigator Ministry. But who is it that you choose to be a mentor or an advisor in your life? And then do you pass that quality on to your kids? Sure, they might come to you, but is there somebody else that have you modeled good, getting a good advice from other people so that they'll know to do that? Handling criticism. Handling criticism will either make you a stronger person or a more determined person if you're successful. If you're not, it'll discourage you, and it will cause you to quit. And so how we help our kids handle criticism is very important. To think for yourself. That's a process of just being able to weigh things, you know, being a good Berean, weighing out a situation and thinking things through for yourself, whether that's in the study of the Bible and for character, or in the study of life. It just makes sense. And then working hard. I probably don't have to tell you. That's the one thing that I feel probably separates kids the most these days is so many kids that are graduating from school now have never learned to work hard. And so if you can instill that value in your kids, they will already be miles ahead in what they do. Oh, and value education. And again, they did some studies. It's not so important where you graduated from in terms of a college, which school, but the fact that you graduated. And so to have gone 1 year to Harvard and not graduated is not as good as to have finished a degree even at a state school or any other school. So it's the accomplishment and the sense of getting the degree that is most important. And so what I say is find a good educational fit for your kids. When my daughter was a senior in high school, my oldest daughter, we did this for our other kids. We took 5 kids with us to a variety of different schools, and we traveled around, and in 5 days we visited 6 campuses. And I don't know if you know the way the younger generation thinks of things now, but it wasn't so much the academic quality of the school that they were looking at or what they could do with the major, but when we walked on the campus, it was, how does it feel? You know, can I see myself here? You know, everything is about feeling and relational, and so we made that decision, and it turned out to be a very good one. So the kids, for our daughter anyway, she stayed at that school and eventually graduated because she felt like this was someplace she could belong and be a part of, and so it wasn't so much the academic program. Live below your means, you know that. That's probably the most critical factor for financial success, is wherever you are in life, just learning to live below your means. And so at first you tithe, second you save, and then you live on what's rest. And that's kind of a very short budgeting outline. Okay, reward behaviors that you want to encourage. And I'm kind of getting into this issue. With your estate and with your kids, what we want to do is to use our money and our resources to reward things in our children that we want to encourage. And then, so that causes them to do their best. And at this point, we have to move into a different part of our presentation because this is about really passing the baton. Passing the baton on to our kids. What is it that we want to do for them and to encourage in them so that as we get as they grow into adulthood or as they're adults and they're raising their own children or even as they're getting through, that we've done we know we've done the right things. And in a trust or in your will, you can specifically designate money to certain kinds of activities that you want to encourage. So even if you shouldn't live long enough to distribute the money for those things, your will will your trust will continue to follow your wishes. The first thing that we want to provide for is medical expenses. If there's any kind of medical expenses that you might that your kids might have, those are things while we're adult, you know, while we're parents, we would provide for our kids. Even those things that may not be covered by other insurance. In other words, it may be important for a child to be able to get LASIK eye surgery because of what they're doing. Now that wouldn't be covered by an insurance, I don't think. Or some cosmetic dental work or different things like that. And so if we set money aside, those are the things that we'd like to see the money spent for rather than the brand new $75,000 Hummer. And so in the medical expenses, the other thing is, as many of you probably know, if you've ever started your own business or gone into business for yourself, probably the last thing you think about when you're younger is health care. You know, you think, well, that's an expense I really don't have to handle right now. But that's something that the trust can step in and help provide for your kids, which could be a necessary thing. The other thing is education. Education, college education, Christian education for kids, vocational education, any kind of training that you think would be important. And again, money that can be set aside in your trust, in the trust, can go toward your grandchildren's education as well. One of the things that I like to do is set up what's called a legacy trust. in an estate plan. And a legacy trust is money that's set aside to pay for these kinds of activities, and only these kinds of activities. So that the things that you would have normally perhaps provided for your children during your lifetime will be provided for your children and your grandchildren after your death. But things that you wouldn't have given your money to your kids for will not be won't be used for that. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a bailout? In other words, a child ends up with a scholarship and doesn't need that trust money for education.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why when I set it aside, I don't do education funds, you know, as a separate deal or anything like that. What I want is I want a pool of money available that can provide for these things. And so and that way I can treat children, you know, and so that child may get a scholarship, may not use money for education, but they may use it for ministry service. Because that's one of the things that I want to provide for. If a child wants to take 6 months off and do missionary work or work part-time at a shelter or do whatever kinds of things, then I want to do that. And that's one of the things these are my two oldest kids several years ago, but we took them with us to Thailand. And our family has an orphanage that we operate in Thailand now and an outreach to tribal people that all of our kids are really involved in. In fact, my youngest daughter, who's not here now, is over in Thailand right now. And when two years ago, we were sitting around at Christmas and we were talking and saying, you know, where would you like to, spend our family vacation this year? Because our kids are all out of the house. In fact, I have the dilemma of having one in Los Angeles, one in Seattle, and one in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And so it's vacations are pretty important to us. What would you like to do? Do you want to go to Mexico, or should we think about, you know, Southern California? And they said, you know, we'd really like to go back to Thailand and work with the people there. It's a bonding experience for your family, and it's something that is, I can't tell you the value that it is for kids to be able to spend time overseas. It is literally a life-changing experience. And so to the degree that we can set money aside so that our kids could do that, that's one of the things that I like to encourage. Down payment on a home. And again, why would I just say a down payment on a home instead of being able to buy a home? Well, it's because what's going to happen then is they're going to buy a home that, one, they will have most of the ownership in. They'll be providing 80 to 90% of it. The other thing is that they will qualify for a home at their current income level rather than buying a home that is above them. And that's an important thing, is you want kids to be responsible in that area. So if they have to go out and get the loan on the balance, then they're going to qualify in an area that is comfortable for them to make the payments. And that money can be saved. So that's why I usually say just a down payment on a home rather than the purchase. And I know that was I had a stilted life. I went back to law school when I was 31 years old with three kids. Bad thing to do, but anyway, when we came out, if we hadn't had some help from my parents being able to get into a down payment, and my wife's parents to get into a home, it would have been very difficult. And so I'd like to encourage people in that area. Loan for business startups. How many of you are in business for yourself or have started a business over your lifetime? Okay. Well, this is something that if you look at the statistics now, as we see the employment statistics going out, most of the new jobs are being created in the entrepreneurial arena. Small businesses are people going into business for themselves. I'd like to make that at least available for my kids if there's something that they want to pursue. And so in my trust, I've structured a situation to make a business loan to them. Now, you guys that are involved in business, you can understand this. Why would I want to do a loan versus just allowing money to be used?
Accountability for repayment.
Accountability for repayment, yeah.
You want to make sure it's a viable idea. They're tacked into it.
Right. That gives, yeah, it gives one, it gives somebody the ability to approve it. So there's, yeah, it's a viable business plan. The second thing is that there is some accountability for repayment in that process. In other words, it's not just money, because if you're just sinking money into a business without the idea of having to repay it, you may be structuring a business that's not economically sound, because that's not the, you know, business works is you repay those. The other thing is that what I want a loan for is capital items as opposed to operational expenses, because in capital items, I can take a security interest in that from the trust. And so, in other words, if my son wants to start an excavation business and needs a front end loader and some other things like that, I'll loan money and take a security interest in that equipment from the trust. Why? Because if the business goes bankrupt, I get the equipment. If I give my son $50,000 and he puts it into the business, if that business goes bankrupt, we get nothing. And so that's a good situation to do it as well. But in that process, then, it just builds responsibility back for this fund that's outside of their estate. And so it's a helpful thing. It builds character in that process of family vacations. If you have older children, the way I do, and your children are far away, you realize that as kids are starting their families and things like that, it's difficult to get time away for a vacation. It's difficult to get money to pay for a vacation. And so what we've tried to do is to set up situations where we can gather our kids together for a family vacation. It's very important to my wife and I that our kids stay in relationship with each other and that our grandchildren know each other. And we feel like that's part of our responsibility, particularly since we're far away. Now, if you live in the same town, that may be a different type of situation. But I would like to see, I don't mind my money being used for that issue, for that purpose, to rent, a ski lodge for a week in the winter, to pay for a vacation rental in Mexico or someplace like that, so that my kids have something to look forward to, and for a small expense, they can just get there and be a part of that process. And so that's something that I value, because I value family life and I value the fact that we want to have our kids together.
Bill, you're talking kind of present. I mean, have you set this trust up present situation?
I have, but what I'm telling you is that these are the things that as I look at it currently in my estate, these are the things that I would look to pay for my kids. But I want my estate to follow through and do the same thing. And so basically I have put these provisions in my trust so that if anything happens to my wife and I, these are the kind of things that money will be spent for. It won't be spent for other things.
But what you are saying is you are saying present now, because if you die now, you want these things to happen.
Yeah.
We always think we're going to die in 20 or 30 years or whenever that time is, and there's what I want to do, but we forget to do the things. You're saying, I want to do those things now, whether I'm here or not here. Right?
Yeah, and that's that goes back to that whole issue in Proverbs of leaving inheritance for your children's children. What am I doing now that influences the values for my kids? And if I value these things, in other words, if my son wants to start a business and he said, we're newly married, we're going to forego the medical insurance because, that's an extra expense. And I step in and say, well, we'll cover your medical expense, your medical insurance for a while until you can get going here. What does that say? Well, it says that's an important thing. And we want you to be covered and protected. And it's a really important thing for his wife, even though she may not say that. And same thing on these other issues. These are the things that we think are important.
The family vacations is so crucial, because down the road, again, on your estate, however you set it up, if your kids are all in accord with each other and they're all close with you as parents, it can make all the difference on everything going smoothly. And just from the standpoint of enjoyment of the extended family, just to throw in a plug, we've been blessed with five kids, all married, and we get a cabin at Hume Lake in California.
Yeah, great.
And last year we had to go to two cabins. And so it's just a wonderful way to keep the family together and the the cousins among the your grandkids. It's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so that's why I guess what I'm really saying is my fishing pole broke. But it's kind of like, you know, the old adage, you can give a child a fish and he eats for a day, or you can give them a fishing pole and they can eat for a lifetime. And so what we're trying to do is to make an inheritance last and to make that be a family resource that's available and perpetuates your values. And so it's not going to be used for things that you wouldn't care to be used for. Another way of looking at it is you can have one chicken dinner, or you can have a chicken that lays an egg for a lifetime. And so what would you rather have? What would you rather pass on in the way of inheritance? And if you're a businessman, then think of it this way. If you're going to invest, what are you going to invest in? Are you going to invest in a capital asset, or are you going to invest in an operational asset? If you're giving money away that they can just use to live, then you're inflating an income for a period of time that's going to eventually dissipate. If you're building values in, then you're putting capital investments into your kids that will pay dividends for future generations.
Coming back to that education, how have you structured that? I mean, so is it just paying for their total education, or a loan even to the state for their education so that they will pay it back to the state sometimes?
Well, and that's, I guess one of the things that you can structure it whatever way you feel most important about it. You know, it's so hard to tell into the future. In other words, I don't have any grandchildren now, so it's hard for me to predict what would I want to be paid for my grandchildren in terms of that. And my other kids, we've made it through college, which, is a great ordeal to be through. But as I think about it, in that situation, I want to put in a piece that talks about the value of education and what I want to be important in that, and then I want to turn it over to the parents to make that choice, because it might be perfectly appropriate for one child to go to, you know, automotive tech school, where another one goes to Harvard, you know, and based on their happiness and what they want to accomplish in life. And so I want to put that in the hands of somebody else's. I don't want to make an arbitrary decision and say, well, that's not as good. You know, you don't want to do that. I'm not going to pay for somebody to do that, because in one situation it may not be a good use. Just by way, do you know what this is? That's poultry in motion. Let's see. Now I lost my place. I lost my signal. I lost my place. I just added this one last night, and I did weddings at the bottom. I have two daughters. Both of them are married, and so I've gone through that terrible experience. And I realized that's another issue where, it'd be good to set parameters for and help them understand. Because, any of you fathers of daughters, yeah, my condolences. That wedding can be an unusual experience in terms of the expense, the involvement, and everything else. And so I want to, I certainly want to see things set aside for that, but I want that to be reasonable in the whole process and the structure. And so someone mentioned that to me recently, and I thought, that's a pretty good idea. I think I'll put that in there.
I thought you sold the house to pay for that.
Yeah. Yeah, you heavily mortgage it. That's true.
Part of it is we found no weddings.
Mm-hmm. But, I used to tell people I have four children. All of them are boys except for three. And as I look ahead at my estate, I thought, I'm not sure Bill Gates could raise my kids the way they want to be raised, but that's another issue. Plan strategically and not tactfully, not tactically. As we use our resources, we want to plan strategically for the allocation of what we have. And that means we want to have our plan tied together, so that things kind of come together in a master plan for what we want to accomplish. I want to give you just a brief example of how a plan was not followed and the disastrous results. You may have remembered several years ago, Jacqueline Kennedy died. And Jacqueline Kennedy at the time had two children, John and Caroline. And she had an estate of about $20 million. Now, in true Kennedy tradition, she had planned the estate in such a way that there would be no estate tax. She was going to fund what is known as a charitable lead trust that would pay income to charity for a period of years, and then which would be the family's foundation, and then would go on to the kids after that time period, estate tax free. Kids, though, elected not to fund that charitable lead trust and take the money outright. In probably the words of a common phrase now, they said, "Show me the money." And so they each took their inheritance and paid the estate taxes on it. And so on their inheritance of $10 million each, they wound up paying about 40% in taxes. And so they wound up with about $6 million out of the inheritance. Now, does anybody remember what happened to JFK Jr. 3 years later? Down in an airplane with his wife, with no children. And so 3 years later, they turn around and on that $6 million, you pay another $3 million worth of taxes. And so an estate, as it gets passed down in a period of 3 years, the government got 70% of those assets. Just simply because the plan wasn't followed.
And that's the bright people that are supposed to know.
And that's, greed has no boundary. That's why character is very important.
So they had a choice in the will or the trust or whatever to do, either pay me now or pay me later, and they said pay me now.
Right.
They didn't
even
have the airport.
That wasn't such a disaster. Just in the government has the money as the Kennedy.
Oh, you're a cruel bunch. Yeah. But it gives you some idea in terms of the planning. And the other thing is that who would better be advised and be more intelligent about the value of this than the Kennedys in terms of rolling your money forward? But yet you had kids a generation down who didn't earn it, who probably never had to work in their lives, making a decision on money, and it turned out to be a bad one. You know, just a little bit aside, because you know, none of us will probably ever be in the situation like a Kennedy or a Carnegie or any of those Rockefellers. But you wonder, how does that money keep going when we have an estate tax? Well, the estate tax was never designed to raise money for the government. It was designed to break up family wealth. And it was designed so that people would break up that family so you couldn't roll huge funds from one generation into a next. But of course, like everything, you know, lawyers got together and figured out how they can get around this process. But what the government has always valued is charity. And so by using a charitable instrument, a family foundation, charitable trusts, they're able to roll money forward using these instruments and reproduce the value in future generations, the same value, plus provide a large sum of money for charity. And so these are monies that would have gone in taxes. And so that's kind of the little key that we don't always think about. When Sam Walton died, at the time, arguably the wealthiest man in the country, he paid no estate tax or very little estate tax. And that was because the majority of his wealth had either been transferred previous to that, or it went into a charitable foundation that his family controlled. Oh, I'll take a pause here, cover one thing real briefly. You know, we talk about trusts and partnerships and corporations and limited liability companies and all things like that. And you're probably saying, why do we have things like that? I mean, what's the purpose of having these different entities? Well, it's very simple. Under the law, you do not have one right that's called ownership. Ownership produces a variety of rights and what we call a bundle of rights. And with the right of ownership, you have control. You have the ability to control that asset. You have title, which means that you can have the asset titled in your name. And you have benefit, which means that you have the right to benefit from that asset. Now, what we do with corporations, trusts, partnerships, LLCs, different legal entities, is we use them to break these things apart. And so what we can do is we can provide benefit to beneficiaries of a trust. Control will be in the hands of the trustee of the trust. And title will be in the name of the trust. from a corporate sense, from a corporate area, title is in the name of the corporation. Control is in the hands of the directors. Benefit is in the hands of the shareholders. From a partnership standpoint, the partnership owns title. The general partner has control. The limited partners, as well as the general partner, have benefit. Now, why is this important? Well, which of these things do you think is most important? Benefit, control, or title?
Control.
Control is the most important, because if I have control, then I can choose who benefits. Which is the least important?
Title.
Why? Because liability and taxes follow title, as you probably well know. You know, if somebody else is driving your car and they have an accident, you will be sued. So in that process, then, that's why we use these things. We use these legal devices to break these things up so that we can get liability protection, we can get some control over taxes, and we can choose who will benefit from it at any given time. That's just a little aside there. Try to get back on track here. I'm going to talk a little bit about charity here. This is probably something that happened in your church. The two guys walk out. Boy, that was the best sermon on giving I've ever heard. Most of the time people think about giving in the sense that you, it's an all or nothing type of proposition. But we can give a variety of different things, and we can give it a variety of different times. At death, since we're talking about estate planning, there are several different ways we can structure a charitable gifts that will make sense. One is we can give a percentage of our estate at death, 10%, just like you would a tithe. That way, 90% is available for the family resource. That way, we're always keeping things in perspective instead of giving a dollar amount. Second thing is we can give a remainder interest. If my kids are young, I want to hold my estate together until the youngest one reaches 22, and then at that point, divide it up, give 50% to charity, 50% to the kids, because I've met my obligations. A contingent gift. If you and your kids are driving on the road, and that semi crosses the middle line, and all of you go to glory at once, then where would the money go? At that point, then, I have no other family responsibilities that are important. I want to see a bigger part of my estate go to charity. You can use a family foundation. In other words, I can make gifts into a family foundation structure where my kids can continue to give that at later generations or as they grow on. And, you know, one of the things that, I mean, if you enjoy the joy of giving, and you understand the joy of giving, part of the way to be able to pass that on to your kids is to put money aside in charity that they can give away that they can't get access to directly for them. And so they get the joy, and they understand that joy of giving. And so we have a certain amount of money that goes into, we have a foundation up in Colorado Springs called the New Horizons Foundation, which is a Christian community foundation that allows you to set up small accounts and have donor advised funds so they can be distributed, and the account can be as small as $2,000. And then a charitable trust for the retirement assets. Okay, if we look at this, I'm going to kind of go through this a little bit quickly, but if you have any questions on it, you can ask me later. You know, I talked about the retirement assets that you have and how that can be they can be dealt with and get rid of that and avoid that income tax. Let's say you have $500,000 in a retirement account. If it's your death, after both you and your wife's death, that goes into a charitable trust. That can pay an income out for, let's make it simple, pays an income out for 10 years at 10% to your children. So it's going to pay out $50,000 a year to them for 10 years. So the full value of that $500,000. Now, this charitable trust is a tax-exempt environment, and hopefully if you do as well as the stock market, at the end of 10 years, you will be giving $500,000 to charity. So in essence, using a structure like this, instead of paying 40% tax when your retirement account goes to your children, they're getting $500,000 over 10 years. Charity's getting $500,000. And so it's what we call a give-it-twice trust. You give your assets first to your children, second to charity. And from charity's perspective, we can wait. But that's kind of the way that works. And so pays an income to the beneficiaries for 10 years. After that, it goes to charity. Your estate receives a charitable tax deduction for that. You avoid the income tax, which is IRD, income with respect to a decedent. And you provide an extended distribution to kids. So in other words, they're getting it over a period of 10 years, not all at once. So the chances of them spending it all at one time, they get to make a few mistakes and still come back. You know, one of the things people say, but gosh, I'm giving that whole estate to charity. The $500,000 is all going to charity instead of my kids. Well, your kids have had the use of it, the full amount, for 10 years. And what is that income interest worth? Well, let me ask you a question. You have a friend who comes to town and he says, hey, can I borrow $1,000? I got the money in my account, but they won't accept my out-of-town check here, so can I write a check to you and get the cash? And you say, yeah, sure, that's fine. And then after you take the check, you realize that he's dated it for 20 years down the road. Now, it's still a check for $1,000. He has $1,000 in his bank account. He shows that to you. Would you still take the $1,000 check? If you would, could you see me after this?
Yes.
No, you probably wouldn't. Why? Because at 7% interest, today that $1,000 is worth $258. At 8% interest, today it's worth $214. At 10% interest, which is what the stock market has averaged over the last 10, 15 years, today that's worth $148, or about 15% of the value. And so when you make an income gift like that to a charitable trust, what are you giving? Well, basically, you're giving 85% of the value to your children and 15% to charity. And so it's all the way you realistically think of things. We think I'm giving it all away to charity, but in reality, the value of the income interest is worth 85% of the value of that money. So it's just something to think about in your planning. What may seem to be a large gift actually works out to be right in line with what your plans and objectives might be. Okay, yeah, if this is something that you want to do, spend the time to do it right. And I would say, because of what I've seen in terms of the way inheritance and money passed on to kids can affect their lives and ruin their situation, if you're just going to pass your money outright to your kids, leave it to charity, because it'll do more good in the long run. Unless you're going to take the time and think through what's best for my children and how would I best want to see my assets left. And obviously, I'm not talking if you're, you know, leaving them $15,000 or $20,000. But I'm saying if their inheritance is going to be fairly significant with respect to their lifestyle, then think it through and take the time to do it right.
Bill, what percentage of, I've told people that people who make a lot of wealth, that 8 cases out of 10, they can't handle it. What percentage of do you see children where that's happened, where they get a lot of wealth, not just a... In 50% of the cases or more, does it really do more harm than good?
Yeah, in the wealth planning materials, there's a saying that says shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in two generations. You know, basically one generation makes the money, the next generation spends it all. And so by the time you get to the third generation, then if they're going to be successful, they have to make it all over again. And so that's why I say 80% of the millionaires in this country today are first generation. They've made it themselves. And so to the degree that you can influence and help your kids with that process, it's just critical because, you know, I should have brought this book along. It's called The Golden Ghetto. It's written by some people who... from very famous families that inherited money, and just the destruction that money caused, the way they were perceived, what they did with their money, how they never worked, they never had, they never really had to have a job, never had any self-esteem, all those issues. Now, we're probably not talking about a situation where for our kids it would be that much money, but just think in terms of your own life. You know, if at 30 years old you had received $200,000, how would that affect you? I mean, outright. You know, would you have said, heck with this job, you know, you'd probably make some bad decisions that after the money was gone, you'd wind up now having disconnected your career or having used it for things that have caused you, you know, to get no further down the line. And so as you do that planning and you do this carefully, should you tell your children? Yeah, I would, because that's part of the value process. You know, what I tell people is, or what I told my kids is that because of the way our trust is set up, your mother and I will be with you always. Our values will be continue to be perpetuated because you'll be hearing about it every, you know, anytime you need to get money for any different things. And so what it kind of forms is, in maybe its best sense, it's a family, it's an investment bank for the family because it's money set aside to provide for a variety, you know, for certain kinds of things that we want. I also keep all their money together. In other words, I don't want broken into three shares or four shares for each kid, because why? I can get better money management together, even if it's $500,000 for four kids. It's better to keep it together and managed, and then you have that pool making distributions, and then there's each child has a share that is in that pool. So if one child goes to Harvard and the other one goes to technical school, they don't, you know, their share goes down, up and down. It's not coming out of that general pool, but it's all managed together. And so there's some family responsibility together for that. And so my kids hopefully would get together and talk about that, but not restrict each other from how they might use their share. But I think that, you know, one of the things I didn't bring up as we finish, and I'll give you just a couple minutes to fill out your evaluation in just a minute. I see a lot of cases. In fact, I'm dealing with one right now with some older people, where kids think that their parents' money is their money, and it's not. You know, you have a responsibility to God for your money, and you have a responsibility to help your kids understand that your money is not their money, because I've seen a lot of kids live for an inheritance. And set aside doing some things that they would or should or could do based on what they think they're going to get in an inheritance situation. And so I wouldn't let my kids have that, foster that expectation. You know, if you're going to give a significant amount of money to charity, I'd let them know that. And I'd let them know that they're not going to just get an outright inheritance, but there may be some money available for the things that we have valued during our lifetimes. That way, then, you're really perpetuating family values. And that will go down on to additional generations. Why? Because then your grandchildren will know that there's money available for mission trips, that there's money available for education, that there's money available for different things like that. Even if you could, depending on the amount of money, for a down payment on a house. So you can cause future generations to be successful in that process. Any questions here as we kind of wind up? Yeah, Dave.
On that family that you used an example there that had about $2 million, uh-huh. Say they had given three-quarters of that to charity and, you know, had a will or whatever. Would there have been any estate tax on it?
If they'd given three-quarters to charity, no, there would not be any estate tax. But unless they did their planning properly, there would have been an income tax. So, and that's why planning is important. And
all the retirement stuff is mm-hmm. where you really get, is that where people are really going to get killed today if they don't plan yeah. to give the retirement stuff to charity or trust?
Yeah, if you're going to make a charitable gift, you want it coming 100% from your retirement assets, because that's the most taxed estate.
If you put a charity on an IRA as a contingent beneficiary, mm-hmm. so yeah. like
certainly can.
You make your wife a beneficiary, but if you both die, then they would become that.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways in the structuring you can do that. One is you can, you know, you and your wife can maintain the tax deferred nature. So you want to have that go directly. And then once it comes out of the IRA or out of a retirement plan, you can have it go directly to charity if you want to, and that takes care of that obligation. Or if it's going to wind up being a significant amount of money and you're not exactly sure how much you'll need in that process, you can have it go into your estate or into your trust, and then have a designation in your trust that it could go to your legacy trust for your children, or if disclaimed, could go into a charitable remainder trust. Or it could go directly into a charitable remainder trust that sits inside of your living trust. That's what I do a lot of, is you just get a charitable remainder trust that plugs right into your will or a living trust, and then at your death, it receives the retirement benefits, comes into being, pays out for 10 years or 20 years, and then goes on to charity.
That person you recommend as a trustee or as
a trustee? My preference is if you know someone, family connection or close friend who's a good advisor, to at least be involved in part. Sometimes banks are what we typically see as trustee, and they're okay, but they don't really manage money that well. And so that's not, and then you have somebody who really doesn't know your family or care making distributions. And so I would rather see that tied in. You can always hire a money manager and direct who you'd like to see manage the money. But I'd like to see, if you have children that are, I've named my children as the trustees. And you can say, well, gosh, they're managing. Isn't that like putting the fox in front of the hen house? Well, it is, but my children are 23, 27, and 28 right now. And so I kind of have a feel for how they're going to deal with things. And I also know that they'll check each other. And I also know that they will honor our wishes. And so what I've done is I have put the conscience behind this, yes, could they take their money and manipulate a way to get it and misspend it? They probably could, but they'd have to get over their siblings and get over our wishes in order to do that. That's the situation. So, or you can name a brother.
If you name somebody, what does that do in the next generation? You have to have a contingency in there for
okay, yeah. Let me explain real briefly how this works, because I think it's a neat setup. In a legacy trust structure, money comes in for the benefit of my kids. It is divided into shares, then one share for each child. Now the primary beneficiary of each share is my child. The secondary beneficiary are my grandchildren. The directions are, it's used for the benefit of my child, but in the event of that child's death, or during their life, they can use it for the secondary beneficiaries of the children. Now, neat thing, that money is outside of those kids' estates for estate tax purposes, for creditors' purposes, and for divorce and family settlement purposes. That can be a pretty significant issue right there, because that's another way to preserve the value of that asset.
I think, didn't you mean the advent of the administrator's death, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. Well, then basically what I say is that if I name my three children to be the trustees over, then whoever dies has an appointment right for the next trustee. They can appoint one of their children, or they can appoint somebody else.
What happens when these funds, say that your children, one or more of the children, do so well in their own business life that they don't really use the funds that are in their portion of it, and the same with their children, your grandchildren. So are the great-grandchildren, whom you may never see, automatically written in, or how does that work with the funds that are not used by your children or even grandchildren?
Well, you set a termination date on it. I'm glad you brought that up, because I've got a couple other things you can pick up when you go out. First is, this is a legacy trust worksheet, which kind of helps you plan through these things, what things you want to cover. But one of the most important things you do is when to terminate this. In most states that we represent here, you can either have it last for a life in being plus 20 years or 100 years. So you could run this thing out 100 years if you wanted to. There are some states, North Dakota, Alaska, Delaware now, where you can have it last in perpetuity. It could last forever if you wanted it to. But I think it's important for you to set a time of termination, mainly because as you start running these tentacles out, unless you start funding some insurance in there, your money gets pretty small by the time you get 15 grandchildren or 30 great-grandchildren. And so what I recommend usually is that you terminate this thing at maybe the death of all your children. And then at that point, it either can go to charity or it could be divided up to and distributed to grandchildren or something like that.
Well, it's true, it gets spread out, but by the very interest of it, it accumulates quite a bit at the same time, doesn't it?
It could, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, when people really catch the vision for something like this and you see that this is sitting outside of everybody's estate for estate tax purposes and for creditors' purposes and everything else, it's like having your parents with you all the time. You know, I mean, there's a pool that's always available to fund different things, and you may find that as you get down the road, yeah, by the time you get to great grandchildren, there's money available in that share. But now the people who are making the guidelines for distribution are getting a little bit more specialized. You know, now maybe it's more for medical or more for certain kinds of education. We're not going to do any business loans or whatever. You know, so yeah, you can. You know, it becomes basically a family asset that helps the institution. Yeah.
And Bill, as we all then break out and go to our respective cities and so forth. What quick advice could you give us on choosing a good person to guide us through this? We're all individual and different.
Yeah. Over here on the table is an estate planning inventory and my business card at the NAVS. You can pick that up on your way out, and if you want to fill that out, and you can contact me. I'd be happy to give you some advice. We can correspond by mail or email on the telephone, talk through some things, and I can help you find a lawyer in your area that might be able to help. One of the big things is that and then the other thing is that there's a legacy trust workshop which covers these issues that I just mentioned, helps you do that planning. And finally, there's a user's guide to our website, and this enables you to run charitable trust plans or gift annuities, things like that, off of a website. There's a calculator on there. So if you're wondering how would this work for me in a charitable trust, you can find out on that and then get in contact with me as well. So those things, three things here. One of the things that I tell people, the honest truth is that lawyers don't make money on wills. And so when by the time you go in there, meet with them, they explain everything you need to explain. You give them all your details. They prepare the document. You come back in and meet with them. It winds up being kind of it's not a great moneymaker. And so lawyers are not usually interested in spending a lot of time with this process of teaching you and helping you. But that's the most important. So when you go in, you want to know what you want, and you want to say, this is what I want. And so that's the planning process that we'd be happy to help you with. And I have another attorney that works for me at the NAVS who's also available for this. So that's kind of the nice thing about the Navigators is you probably can appreciate. We try to do everything in a quality manner, and so we have very professional people available to help you in advisement and to help get these things done.
One thing that you guys should know about this brand new thing, Ron Blue is one of the better financial Christian advisors around the country. What Ron found out was that there were a lot of Christian financial advisors, and they were good financial advisors secularly, and they were good Christians, but they had no idea how to put Christian biblical principles with financial advice. So Ron has formed an association called Christian Financial Planners, and they're doing seminars. And so many of you have financial planners, and I would ask them if they're a believer to say, are you part of that association? Because they go through three different seminars, but this is brand new within the last 12 months. And you need to have financial planners that have a biblical mindset, and then also attorneys and estate guys like Bill who know how to put that together, because otherwise we live in a secular system that teaches secular things, and Bill's given us a godly point of view of training our kids is more important than our estate plan. It's what you do beforehand. So it's really good to get that, and I would encourage you to check that out too.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, Bruce.
You can at least download preliminary trust and that off the website. Just as a
Well, what you can download, you don't download trust. You can download a you can work with a calculator to show you like what how to use a gift annuity or the value of a charitable trust, a bargain sale arrangement, different kinds of things like that. But But it's we've got a lot of there's a lot of information now. It's on what's known as navgift.com that we set up specially for this, and that's on this sheet too. If you just want to pick it up, a lot of good financial information too.